How many of you remember the movie Patch Adams? Robin Williams, he's the doctor with the big clown nose he wears. The story is that he's, you know, this doctor who's trying to inject compassion into a medical system where there isn't any, where patients are being treated like objects and not as human. And it's a fight for him to do this. And everyone's fighting against him as he's just trying to bring compassion into a system that should be compassionate. And in the middle of him fighting, a fight he shouldn't have to fight, something tragic happens in the movie. His girlfriend, fiance, is murdered by one of the patients in the hospital. And that brings Patch Adams to a crisis moment. And he winds up on the edge of a cliff talking to God. Watch what happens.
Suffers enormous amounts of pain and dies. Maybe you should have had just a few more brainstorming sessions prior to creation. You rested on the seventh day. Maybe you should have spent that day on compassion.
That's asking the question he started with, where's the justice? Can we trust God that he actually does know what he's doing, that he actually will do good and will do what is right? Can we trust God? Will God do what is right for the situation going on in Ukraine right now? Will God do what is right? Can we trust him for justice? Or any of the other seemingly countless conflicts going on around the world that we're not paying attention to right now? What will God do for the children in our world who are going hungry and being abused and misused, innocent as they are? Can we trust God to do what is right? For the people who are being trafficked against their will, having their lives destroyed and ruined by evil people, can we trust God to do what is right? What kind of God is God? When it comes to what kind of God God is, the question of justice tells us everything. How he handles justice will tell us everything about him. And we've been following the life of Abraham as he learns to have faith in God and in his justice is going to be the lesson today. Because today, Abraham needs to learn a lesson in what it means to do what is right, to do what is just. And God's going to teach it to him. So open your Bible with me or follow along on the screen or open our app and you can follow along and take notes there. We are in Genesis, the second half of chapter 18 and going into chapter 19. We're going to be going through a lot of scripture, a long story today. And it's a story with a lot of adult content and difficult things to wrestle with, as we said before. We ended last week, remember, three messengers had come. These are divine beings. They were sitting and eating with Abraham and talking to him and Sarah about how they were going to have a son at their old age. Well, when that meal was over, they got up to leave. And this is what one of them said, speaking for the Lord. He says, verse 16, when the men got up to leave, they looked down towards Sodom. It was an evil city. And Abraham walked along with them to see them on their way. And then the Lord said, speaking through one of his messengers there, shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do? Abraham is surely going to be a great and powerful nation, and all nations on earth are going to be blessed through him, because I've chosen him that he will direct his children and household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just, so that the Lord will bring about for Abraham what he has promised him. In other words, Abraham needs to know what it means to do what is right and just in this world. So I'm going to show him by letting him see how I deal with the evil going on in Sodom. So school is open here for Abraham. That's what's going on here. School is open. He's got to learn what it means to do what is just and right. And these next two verses are what separates God from any other deity Abraham had ever heard of in his life. Look at the next couple verses, verse 20 and 21. Then the Lord said, the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great and their sin so grievous that I will go down and see if what they have done is as bad as the outcry that has reached me. If not, I will know. And that tells us two things about God that most people, it might seem very obvious, but a lot of people don't know if they can trust this. One, it tells us God actually cares about people. And that's not earth-shattering. We all here in church know that, or we think that. But a lot of people in the world don't believe that God actually cares. But here, God is paying attention to the people who are crying out because they're being abused and misused. God is not, as some people think, a grumpy dad lashing out at his kids and punishing them because they woke him up from a nap. That's not what God is like. Abraham learns that God is actually paying attention to people, listening and observing and hearing the calls of those who are hurt and mistreated and abused. That's the first thing he learns about God. The second thing he learns about God, God says, I am going to see for myself. God cares about the truth. God doesn't just, let's just wipe them all out. God goes and investigates. He goes to see what's happening for himself. Now, of course, God knows what's happening, but this is God showing, I'm going to, when I bring justice, I do it right. I investigate. I look, I enter in, and I see what's going on. That's what we learn about God here. He doesn't judge the way we often judge based on a few sound bites and headlines. Anybody here guilty of that ever? He goes and sees and knows. And people wonder, especially in the church, we wonder all the time, and you might get people ask you questions about God's justice and how could God do certain things, and that doesn't make sense, and I don't get this. And we get questions like, you know, what about babies who are born and die and never hear about Jesus? What happens to them? Or what about people in parts, remote parts of the world who never hear about Jesus? What's the just thing to do? Or do they go to hell? Does God send them to hell because they've never heard the gospel? What about people whose parents just fill their heads with hate from the time they're born and that's all they know? How is God gonna deal with all that? And these are the kinds of questions Christians wrestle with. These are certainly the kind of questions if you're talking to a friend who's not a Christian, brings up because they want to test and see, is God really just? Is God going to do what's right? And here's the answer. The Bible doesn't answer all those little minute questions we have. The Bible answers the questions that we need the answers to. And here's what the Bible tells us. Right here in this part, and we're going to learn some more, but right here for now, what we've learned is this. God cares and God investigates and deals with truth. When he brings justice, he does it based on truth, what's really happening. That's what we've learned so far. God cares, he hears the cries of people, and he's gonna do what's true. He's gonna deal with truth. But what is he going to do? That's the next question. Seeing the truth, hearing the cries, what is God going to do? Is he going to do what's right about what's going on in Sodom, that city where people are being abused and hurt? So Abraham asks the obvious question next in verse 23. Abraham approaches him and says, will you sweep away the righteous with the wicked? What if there are 50 righteous people in the city? Will you really sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous people in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to kill the righteous with the wicked, treating the righteous and the wicked alike. Far be it from you, will not the judge of the earth do right? And the Lord said, if there are 50 righteous people in Sodom, I'll spare the whole place. Then again, it's like sitting in class. Okay, what if there are 40? Abraham asks. And he says, if it's 40, I won't sweep the city away. Okay, I'm running some numbers here. What 30? What if 30? And Abraham just keeps going, what about 20? He finally gets to 10. His 10th question in the whole discourse here is, what if there are just 10 righteous people there, God? Will you still destroy it? And God says, I won't destroy it for just 10 even. And I grew up thinking this was Abraham bargaining with God because Sodom is the city that Lot lived in. And we're told that Lot was a righteous man in Peter. He did some bad things. He made some mistakes. We'll see some of them today. But we're told he's a righteous man living in this horrific city, and every day he was heartbroken by the evil in the city. And Abraham is concerned about Lot, and so I grew up thinking, oh, he's just trying to bargain to see, you know, can I rescue Lot? But he stops at 10, and Lot's only one, and he's got two daughters and a wife. But it's not Abraham bargaining. It's Abraham probing the depth of God's justice. And it all centers around the one question, will not the judge of the earth do what is right? Won't you spare the city if there are 50, 40, 30, 20, 10? Won't you spare the city for those righteous people and not sweep them up in your just punishment? But if you think about it, Abraham's solution doesn't work either. It's not just either. Abraham's question proposes a solution that is also bad. To spare the city and not do anything isn't good either. If it's unjust to let the righteous suffer the punishment of the unrighteous, the wicked, then it's also unjust to allow the wicked to enjoy the blessing of the righteous, right? We can't just let it go. Evil has to be dealt with in this world. Will God do what is right, though? Or will God just crumple it up and throw it away? How will God do what is right? The talking part's over in this lesson. Now we're going to step into the mucky part of the story and see how bad it is, because it's bad. It's really, really bad. And you wonder, how bad could it be? Like I said, Peter tells us that Lot was tormented every day by this. The prophet Ezekiel talks about how this city was so corrupt, because he warns Israel when they're getting like this, like Sodom. And he names some things. He says they're fat and they're arrogant. They mistreat people. They mistreat the poor. They mistreat the foreigner. They mistreat the immigrant. They do detestable things right in my face, right in front of me, God says. And so these two messengers, they go down into the city. Two of the messengers go down into the city to see how bad it is. And as they walk into the city, Lot is sitting there at the gate. Now, typically, the people who sat there at the gate were officials of the city, and those who sat there to help judge cases and things within the city. So Lot may have even gotten to the point where he was trying to hold back the evil of the city, serving there as a leader. And he sees these divine beings, and they walk into the city, and he says, no, come with me, come to my house. Have you ever come to church and brought a friend and thought, oh, I hope Pastor Anders doesn't say something weird today? So they come into a city. He's like, I got to get him into my house before they see what this place is like. So he pulls him in and gets him into his house. And here's what happened. When he saw them, he got up to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. My lords, he said, this is chapter 19, verse 2 now, please turn aside to your servant's house. You can wash your feet and you can spend the night and then go your way early in the morning. And they said, no, we'll spend the night in the square. Sleep out under the stars in the middle of the city. And he insists, Lot says, strongly that they go with him and enter his house. And he prepares a meal for them, and he bakes bread without yeast, which means they're going fast. And they eat. And before they had gone to bed, all the men from every part of the city of Sodom, both young and old, surrounded the house. They call to Lot, where are the two guys we saw go into your house before? Bring them out. We want to have sex with them. Lot went outside to meet them, and he shut the door behind him. And he said, no, my friends, do not do this wicked thing. Look, I have two daughters that have never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you, and you can do what you like with them, but don't do anything to these men, because they've come under the protection of my roof. Ah, get out of our way, they replied. This fellow came here as a foreigner, and now he wants to play the judge of us. We'll treat you worse than them. And they kept bringing pressure on Lot, and they started pushing forward to break down the door. Okay, this is bad. This is really bad. Imagine you went to visit a friend who lives in, say, Providence, Rhode Island, and you're sitting in their house eating dinner, and all of a sudden there's a crowd outside, and they're banging on the door because they want your friend to send you out so they can rape you. Just imagine that. How horrible that city must have been that they would do that. But also, hopefully, your friend wouldn't give you up. And hopefully, he also, if he had daughters, wouldn't offer to send them out either, because that's not good. And I want to take a minute, because Lot's daughters are going to play a big role in this story and in how God is going to bring about justice. But what Lot does here is confusing. We said, the Bible calls him a righteous man, but this doesn't sound good. But let's just appreciate the place Lot's in, and there's no excuse for offering your daughters this way. Don't do this. This is not the Bible prescribing a behavior. It's describing what happened. There's Lot, and one, he's under obligation by their culture to protect anyone who comes into his home. These two male guests would have been seen as more valuable than any of his children, whether they were sons or daughters. And protecting them culturally would have been important. And so you could just see how Lot is shaped by that culture and that perspective. Also, you could see Lot, if he recognized that these were divine beings, as Abraham had, then he's in this place, well, wait a minute, I can't let anything happen to them, because then what's going to happen to me? And you could just see Lot in a place where, what is the right thing to do? Is anything even going to work? Would anything ever really even satisfy the lust of these men and the sickness of the sin in them that was calling for this? Would his daughters know? They would have chewed through his daughters and then come after those guys as well. And Lot, there is no stopping. There's no satisfying this sin-sick appetite. And there's Lot trying to do what's right when he can't even see what the right thing is to do, stuck there between evil, trying to hold it back from his door. And here's what happened. Verse 10, the men inside, these two divine beings, they reach out and they pull Lot back into the house and they shut the door. Then they struck the men who were at the door of the house, young and old, with blindness so that they couldn't find the door. The two men then said to Lot, do you have anyone else here, sons-in-law, sons or daughters, or anyone else in the city who belongs to you? Get them out of here, because we are going to destroy this place. The outcry to the Lord against its people is so great that he has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law. His daughters were engaged at the time. And so he went to the two sons who were pledged to marry his daughters, and he told them, hurry and get out of this place, because the Lord is about to destroy the city. God's about to bring justice here. And his sons thought he was, in the NIV translation, it's joking. It's hard to convey the sense of this word. It's more than joking. It's actually kind of like inappropriate joking. It's almost like mocking. They hear him say that God's going to bring justice, and to them, it sounds like a cruel joke. God's going to do what? God doesn't care about this place. God never stepped in to do anything. God's not, we can't trust God to do anything about this place. To them, it's like a cruel joke, and they don't believe it. It's never going to happen. Speaking about justice can seem like a cruel joke in this world, especially to those who've suffered injustice over long periods, decades, centuries. Whatever the motivation of that injustice has been, whatever the cause of that injustice has been, it can seem like a cruel joke to offer false hope. And so these two sons-in-law, they just dismiss him. Because after a while, everyone assumes God must not care. Otherwise, why do these things happen around us? They don't believe that God's going to bring justice, that he'll do what's right. So as the sun rose, the coming of the dawn, verse 15, the angels urged Lot, saying, hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you're going to be swept away when the city is punished. And when Lot hesitated, the men grabbed his hands and the hands of his wife and of his daughters, and they led them safely out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them. As soon as they had brought them out, one of them said, flee for your lives. Don't look back or turn back, and don't stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the mountains or you're going to get swept away in what God's about to do. But Lot said to them, no, please, if I found favor in your eyes, you've shown me great kindness in sparing my life, but I can't go to the mountains or the disaster will overtake me. Maybe he thought they couldn't make it. We're not sure why he didn't want to go there, but he's like, I'll die if we have to go there. Look, there's a town down there. Let me just go there. It's small. Let me flee to it. It's small, isn't it? Then my life will be spared there. And they told him, okay, fine. We'll grant this to you, and we won't overthrow that town that you're talking about. But go there quickly, because I can't do anything until you reach that town. And so it's called Zoar, place of refuge. And they're waiting until Lot and his daughters and his wife get to Zoar before they bring God's justice and punishment on Sodom. By the time Lot reached Zoar, the sun had risen over the land. And then the Lord rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. Thus he overthrew those cities and the entire plain, destroying all those living in the cities and the vegetation and the land. But in the process of all this, verse 26 tells us, Lot's wife had turned back, and she became a pillar of salt. Early the next morning, when Abraham got up and returned to the place where he had stood before the Lord, he looked down and toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the plain and saw dense smoke rising from the land like smoke from a furnace. So when God destroyed the cities of the plain, he remembered Abraham, and he brought Lot out of the catastrophe that overthrew the cities where Lot had lived. Will God do what's right? Will God punish just randomly? Or will God do what's just and preserve the righteous from punishment? And here's Abraham's answer. God took Lot, the one righteous person in the city, flawed as he was, incapable of seeing what's right to do many times as he was, but he pulled him and his family out so that he could enact his justice on that town for the evil they had done in front of him and to so many people. God hadn't spared Lot the pain and agony of living among that town. Lot chose to live there. But God did not lump him in with the unrighteous when he brought his punishment. Yeah, but what about Lot's wife? Right? I mean, that's the question. I grew up with the wrong idea about Lot's wife, and it messed up my view of God, I think, for a while. Because in all the pictures I grew up seeing about this story, it was pictures of Lot and his wife and their two girls, and they're running up a hill, and the flannel graph had, looks like that, or whatever the picture was. And then it's like Lot's wife just, maybe she hears a ball of fire hit the city. And it's like, oh, what was that? And she just looks back, takes a peek, and boom, turns to stone. And all my life, that's kind of, as I was when I was younger, that's how I thought this went, that she just happened to just look back a little bit. But who wouldn't look back when you're hearing fire rain from heaven? And I had it all wrong, first of all, because the fire doesn't rain down from heaven until Lot and his daughters are already in Zoar, until they're already there, because they wait. It's because I also didn't understand this look back. It wasn't just, oh, I wonder what's happening. It was, this word means to turn back. It means that she, in the way it's written, she took her eyes off of Lot, it said, and looked behind. Instead of looking and following and getting away from Sodom, she turned around. So effectively what seems to have happened is as they're going, walking to this other city, she decides, Lot, you're an idiot. There's no judgment coming. There's no fire from heaven coming. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what these two knuckleheads are talking about. We don't even know them. They're not from here. I'm going back. And she went back. And to help make that even clearer, we have what Jesus said when he was talking about how people who follow him should follow him, fix their eyes on him, and don't turn back. He says in Luke 17, it was the same in the days of Lot. People were eating and drinking and buying and selling and planting and building. But the day Lot left Sodom, fire and sulfur rained down from heaven and destroyed them all. It will be just like this on the day of the Son of Man is revealed. On that day, no one who was on the housetop with possessions inside should go down to get them. Likewise, no one in the field should go back for anything. Remember Lot's wife. Which tells me, God brought the righteous out and so that they would not suffer under his punishment. But it tells me that the unrighteous cannot escape. Those who reject God and refuse to follow cannot escape. They actually end up unwittingly hurling themselves back into God's judgment, as Lot's wife did. As much as God did to rescue her, she chose Sodom. It reminded me of what C.S. Lewis once wrote. He said, "There are only two kinds of people in the end, those who say to God, 'Thy will be done,' and those to whom God says in the end, 'Thy will be done.' All that are in hell choose it," he wrote. Without that self-choice, there could be no hell. No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. Those who seek find, to those who knock, it is opened. How could that be true? How could it be true that we could get out of this predicament, out of the evil of this world, and actually find joy? To find the answer to that from this story, we've got to wade through a little bit more muck. Actually, probably the most disturbing part of the story is yet to come. Lot was afraid to stay in Zoar. Maybe he thought the angels would return and destroy that city too. Maybe he just realized the people here are evil too. Where can we go to get away from all these evil people? They ran into the mountains, he and his two daughters, and they hid in a cave. And they just started living in the cave there in order to escape the evil. But they weren't able to escape the evil that was inside of them. Verse 31 of Genesis 19 tells us, "One day the older daughter said to the younger, 'Our father's old, and there's no man around here to give us children, as is the custom all over the earth. Let's get our father to drink wine and then sleep with him, preserve our family line through our father.' And that's what they did. They got him drunk. One night, the older daughter slept with him. The next night, got him drunk again. The younger daughter slept with him, and they both became pregnant by their father. They had gotten out of Sodom, but they had not gotten Sodom out of them. It's not enough to get out of Sodom. We need something to get Sodom out of us. We all think sometimes, oh, if my situation could just change, everything would be better. The problem I've found in my life is I can change situations, but I always bring me into the new situation. I bring that sin in me into the new situation." Abraham only got to learn some of the lesson of faith here. He only got a portion of the picture. He didn't get the whole picture. He didn't get the whole answer about God's justice. He saw that God hears people and he cares about people and he investigates because he cares about justice, and that God will not just lump together the unrighteous and the righteous and punish everybody the same. He saw all that, but he didn't learn what God would do to actually rescue us from the Sodom inside of us. He saw what God could do to rescue them out of Sodom, but he didn't see what God could do to rescue us from the Sodom inside of us. That's the larger faith lesson you and I need to learn. And that has everything to do with Lot's two daughters. Because let me show you. Both of Lot's daughters, verse 36, became pregnant by their father. The older daughter had a son, and she named him Moab. He is the father of the Moabites of today. What does Lot's daughter's baby have to do with the hope that we have that we can get Sodom out of us? Do you remember that the people of Moab, and fast forward a little bit in history, there was a woman from Moab named Ruth. Do you remember the story of Ruth? Who was faithful to her mother-in-law, Naomi, after her husband died. She traveled with Naomi back to Israel and was faithful to her, and then became married to a guy named Boaz. And they had a son named Obed. And Obed was the grandfather of David, King David. See where this is going? The line of Jesus was born in the ashes of Sodom, in the filth of this moment, of this brokenness, the hope of us being removed from Sodom and more of Sodom being removed from us was born here in this moment. Will God allow the righteous to suffer the punishment of the unrighteous? The answer is actually yes. God will allow the righteous to suffer the punishment of the unrighteous, because that's the only way to get Sodom out of us and get us out of Sodom. God has to make transformation possible in our lives. It's not enough to just get us out of Sodom and rescue us. Oh, now we get out of this bad world. He had to do something to get it out of us. And in order for that to happen, the righteous would have to suffer for the unrighteous. And that's what Peter tells us in his letters. It says, for Jesus, the Christ, suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. Because in the end, the truth is there's no one righteous. Not Abraham, not Lot. No one in that city. Not you, not me. Only Jesus. But Jesus suffered and died and overcame the grave to make real transformation possible in your life and my life. To forgive us and then make that transformation possible. That's what Jesus has done in us. God offered his son into this evil world and allowed this evil world to devour him. Jesus willingly stepped into this evil world and allowed sin to devour him, but he overcame it when he rose from the dead. And that is what gives you and I hope, not just, oh, one day we'll get out of this place, but right now, Jesus can begin to get this out of us, the sin out of us that plagues us, that follows us everywhere we go. That's what that butterfly in that clip from Patch Adams really means. Whatever the movie writers meant, I don't care. What it really means and reminds us and tells us, the butterfly stands for transformation. And that's what Jesus makes possible, a metamorphosis in our lives from guilty and deserving God's just punishment to being declared righteous and living this new life, being born again. That's only found in Jesus. And those who follow him and don't turn back find the joy of that. Will God do what's right? He already has. Jesus has done what is right and good so that you and I can get out of Sodom and get Sodom out of us. So what do we do now? What do we do now? Because we're still living in the middle of it. We're still living in the middle of a Sodom world, and we're still struggling with Sodom inside of us. The first thing to do is today, confess the Sodom inside of you. Ask God to forgive you. Say, Lord, I'm going to follow you, and he will begin to transform you. He will forgive you. But then the next thing we need to do, if you haven't done that, do that. But then the next thing we need to do, as we keep living in this world and suffering through it, is remember what God's word tells us. Read through the book of Revelation. It tells us again and again that the righteous will suffer through this world, but they will not suffer God's judgment. That when God judges this world, he will not just punish those who put their faith in Jesus along with those who reject him. God will bring justice, but it will be good justice and right justice for those who follow him. And as we suffer in this world, what God tells us is that our cries, and there's pictures of this all through Revelation, our prayers, our cries, they rise up to heaven like lighting incense. And God takes them and puts them together. They become the fuel for his justice in this world. Because as we go through this world and then person after person rises up and tries to create domineering kingdoms, as nation attacks nation, as person attacks person, as all this evil happens, it's been happening since the fall. It is nothing new. It just keeps happening in this ever-growing snowball of evil that should never surprise us. But what God is doing is he's hearing our cries, the cries of his people. He's hearing them. He's listening. He's paying attention. And it says he's putting them together. They become the fuel for his justice that will eventually reign over this world. So that as we suffer in this world, the way Lot suffered in that city, we have a role to play, to cry out to God for justice, not just for ourselves, but for those in this world who are being destroyed by evil. That's our role in this world. Let him drive Sodom out of us, but then lift our voices to him and intercede for those who are being destroyed by evil. I look at those questions of Abraham, and worship team, come back. Let's get ready to sing this last song together. It's going to be a prayer song. I look at that questioning between Abraham and Jesus. About the 50, the 40, the 30, the 20, the 10. And Abraham keeps saying, you know, will you spare for this? Will you spare for this? And I see it a little bit differently, that what if the 50, 40, 30, 20, 10 is a measure of hope? That as long as there's 50, there's still hope for this world to be transformed. Even 30, even 20, even 10, there's still hope. As long as we're here lifting our voices to God, crying out to Him, there's hope in this world for salvation. Judgment Day has not yet come, but we've got to do our part and be voices crying out for God's justice and crying out to the world and offering them God's justice. For some, it will disturb them. They'll think you're mocking them. They'll think you're offering false hope, but we know we're not. We're offering Jesus.